I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
Within this old house live two residents. One of them is John Russell, composer, professor. The other has been dead for over 70 years.
Claire, I'd like to talk to you about the house.
What is it in that house, Claire? What is it doing? Why is it trying to reach me? You've got something of the senator's. He wants it back.
What do you want from me?
Many films will frighten you, but only a few can really terrify you. The Changeling, an experience beyond total fear.
Hello, jingle bells out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast and YouTube channel where we talk about horror movies, science fiction movies, television series, key influences on the topic of the week, and then things that that topic may have influenced going forward in time. Sometimes we go back decades, covering like 100-ish years of cinema entertainment for all of our fans out there. And we're so glad you found us, and hopefully you'll become a fan if you're new. We'd love to hear how you found out about us. Kind of click down below and leave us a comment and say, hey, a friend recommended you, or I saw your YouTube channel and thought Tim was cute, or whatever you want to do. Just do that and let us know. We'd love to hear from you. If you're returning, hey, welcome back. It is the season right now. My name is David, here with my good friend Tim. Tim, we're in our Christmas marathon thing, whatever.
Ho, ho, ho. Only so many shopping days left.
Yes, I know.
Go you better
put
get
up
on
another
it.
Tree. So, yes.
Six is enough.
Well, yeah, I don't understand it, but anyway. I struggle putting one up, and you put up like a dozen.
So. Oh, wow. Well, it's funny that it is the holiday season, because for my genre topic of the week, I watched another holiday movie that came out. I think it was last year. What was the date on it? Yeah. No, actually, it was this year. Yeah, it was this year. Wow. I watched a little movie called Heart Eyes.
Aw, sounds sweet.
It's not. Okay. It looks too clean and tries too hard to be funny and hip.
Ooh, okay.
It's a bizarre mix of horror and rom-com, and to me, it's not scary at all. I see what they were trying to do as far as, I don't right, progress the old notion of a holiday horror movie, but it just doesn't work to me. It's not scary or funny. It's trying too hard. Anyway, it's directed by Josh Rubin, the guy that did Scare Me, which is on my list. I haven't watched it yet, and now I'm a little leery to watch it. He also is known for directing episodes of The Late Late Show with James Corden. So this is, I guess he comes from a humorous background.
Okay,
Sure. So, which makes me think Scare Me is going to be the same way. It was written by Philip Murphy, Michael Kennedy, and Christopher Landon, Michael Landon's son.
Okay.
Which is a very weird connection. The cast is good. It stars Mason Gooding and Olivia Holt. The synopsis is when two coworkers have survived the Heart Eyes killer on Valentine's Day, the two have to find out who it is. Sorry, I messed up my notes. The gimmick is the killer targets couples that are in love.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a strange concept. It gets 78%. It really is. It gets 78% on Rotten Tomatoes with 165 reviews. I would take it down to a 65 easy. There are several issues with this film, namely that it looks too pretty for a horror movie. Mm-hmm. Everything looks like it's on a set. Does that make sense? Okay. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yep. It's clear that Reuben is trying to emulate some kind of Wes Craven Scream energy, that really tongue-in-cheek, cool twist stuff, or humorous twist stuff.
Yeah, very meta.
Yeah. It even says he was trying to do that on IMDb. Which, so if I notice, I mean, if they notice, then most of America notices. And he is not Wes Craven, nor is the writer's Kevin Williamson, for that matter. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would not recommend this movie at all. Hmm. So that's what I did for my little Christmas purge. No, not purge. Binge. Whatever.
Binge, yes. Yeah. Well, I tried to stay in our kind of pseudo genre of the week sort of thing and go more toward horror, sort of, but I actually did something that you have done ahead of me. You did it, I think, this past summer, and I'm just doing it, or you did it months ago, and I'm just doing it. Anyway, this is Jaws' 50th anniversary, and Jaws has a documentary out, a brand new one, which was published by Amblin, called Jaws at 50.
Yeah, it's great.
It is great. It is a really, really great documentary about one of my favorite movies, probably my second favorite movie of all time. And it's directed, I did some.
The first one's Avatar, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Anything by James, the God. No, no.
Sorry.
I really like the way this documentary is put together with the amount of footage that he had, the amount of 8mm footage he had, the behind the scenes stuff, but also the effect of this particular piece of cinema, kind of like when we covered it for the podcast, what effect it has had, its influence in the past 50 years on other filmmakers, and especially other filmmakers, because you have Jordan Peele and James Cameron and the rest of them all talking about the effect of this movie on their lives and how it changed how they did stuff. It's directed by a guy named Laurent, and I'll mispronounce this, but Bozier. French name, obviously. He has done a lot with Amblin and Amblin Entertainment, but he's also got several other biographies out there or documentaries. He did a documentary just on John Williams and Spielberg and their collaboration. It's also excellent. He did another one I haven't seen on Faye Dunaway, which I thought might be interesting to watch.
I've heard things about that, but I have not seen it. I think it's on Max. That's why.
Yeah, so he's a really good documentarian, and he's covered a lot of Amblin. He's got one I haven't seen that I wasn't even aware existed until I did some research on him, called 40 Years of E.T. So another film that I definitely like a lot, so I'll probably have to check that one out. But this has some great – it has all the trivia that we are used to spouting and talking about Jaws, but also some surprises and some stuff, and a very, very candid – Spielberg interview, which has since been cut up into other pieces about Jaws this year, but very candid about how difficult it was on the shoot and then the repercussions years later. I love the story you and I even talked about when I think offline when you had seen it, when he was even working on other stuff at Universal, he would go and get into the boat that was at the Universal ride for Jaws and just kind of zen out and go through the trauma of what happened shooting Jaws. And it's very interesting. It's very clever. It talks about all the struggles that most of us fans know happened during that movie, but just some great interviews with people. I love the interviews with his son, Quint's son, who played Quint, Richard Dreyfuss. Robert Shaw's son, who I didn't know was the one who actually wrote the play that was off Broadway called The Shark.
Yeah, you told me that.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. But yeah, that's what I did. I stayed scary, but scary from a pragmatic approach of looking back at scary sort of thing.
The shark is working.
The shark is working. Yes.
Well, what kind of segue do we have here? We have bad horror romance and good sea horror. So there's really no... Seattle is by the sea, I do believe. Is it not?
Ooh, that's kind of a stretch there. That's a good one.
It is. And it's also on the west coast of the country. Jaws is on the east coast.
But also, I kind of gave it to you with saying, I'll look back at horror from the...
I look back. We are looking back. We're going all the way back to 1980. We're continuing our haunted holidays theme for this December with a little movie from 1980 called The Changeling.
The Changeling, not Changeling. Need to make sure.
Why?
Changeling.
Is there a Changeling?
The movie, I think, made in 2010 or something like that. The one with Angelina Jolie. It's written by J. Michael Straczynski.
Oh, I didn't. You know what? I do know something about that, I think.
Do not get those mixed up at all. It is The Changeling, not the singular Changeling.
Big no.
Difference in the movies.
Big difference. This is an old movie. This movie is 45, 46 years old almost. Mm-hmm. A brief synopsis is John Russell, played by George C. Scott, is a grieving composer who, after the deaths of his wife and daughter in a car accident, which we actually see at the beginning of this film, it's very dramatic, mm-hmm. moves to an old Seattle mansion for peace and quiet. He soon discovers the house is haunted by the spirit of a young boy named Joseph Carmichael. He hears like bangs in the night and mm-hmm. things of a haunted house nature. Through research and supernatural encounters, he learns that the real Joseph, a sickly child, was murdered by his father for his inheritance and replaced with another boy from an orphanage. The adult imposter is now a powerful U.S. senator. Joseph's ghost seeking justice guides Russell to uncover the truth and expose this long buried secret. So we've not only got a haunted house story here, we've got a good mystery going as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I have a little bit of trouble recalling my first experience with this. I know I saw it on videotape with you in the 80s, but I don't recall seeing it before then. So maybe the first time I saw this movie was with you.
I think so. And I watched it on video. I got it because I loved the cover design on the VHS cover. And I think
it's behind me right now.
Yeah, with the wheelchair and then the almost like the shadow in red or in mm-hmm. orange of the boy. And I remember liking it then, and I still like it now.
Yeah, it's a good movie. Really,
this is a very, to me, this is a treasure, an underrated, unappreciated treasure. I think
I would put it in the top 10 of horror haunted house movies, probably.
Oh,
I don't
definitely.
Know if it's the top 5, but definitely top 10.
Definitely. And I'm sure once we get into Keys, we'll talk about other haunted house movies, but I think this is just a well-crafted story. It's well-told. I, kind of like you, we talked offline. I thought Peter Medak was this big, huge, huge director sort of thing. And looking at his credits, no, he is in television, lots of television. But other than he did Species 2 and he did the Ruling Class, which is Peter Sellers. I love it.
He did Zorro, the Gay Blade with George Hamilton. another TV actor, pretty much. And but I've also, yeah, I had that down. He did The Ruling Class. That's probably his biggest claim to fame with Peter O'Toole. But he also directed episodes of Hannibal, which I love that show.
Mm-hmm. And I haven't finished it, but I've heard it's great.
Yes. Yeah, and tons of TV. He is of Hungarian and British descent. I don't know what it is. I always associated him with like William Friedkin and those 70s directors yep. that were big, and he really wasn't that big.
Well, and maybe it's because of the influence this movie had on us, because it is a very, very well-told ghost story and a very well-told haunted house story.
It's well-directed, too.
Very well-directed. And the production design is outstanding. The music, the piano music, the production design. And I did not know, one of my first watch notes for trivia for this was, where did they film this? Where were these sets? Where were these locations? A lot of this is location filming, so it's great. So where did they film it? Blah, 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 blah. You can actually find a couple of YouTube videos that people have done where they've retraced all of the historic places where this movie was filmed and what they used to be before the movie and what they've been since. So it's kind of the influence of those, which is cool. But I did not know until doing research that the house itself was a set. Mm-hmm. I think it is one of the best sets I have ever seen in my life.
Yeah, they built a fake front onto a real house.
Correct, but the real house was already condemned and was going to be demolished anyway. But all of the interiors are in a studio. That is a set, which has that gorgeous wood and those doors and the staircase and everything. All of, and that is just beautiful. It is so good.
It is. It is. It's a good set. Back to Medak or Medak. Do you how do we say it? Medak?
Medak. Let's say Medak. We're going to say Medak. Correct us if we're wrong, folks.
Yeah. I looked him up to see if I could find anything about him, considering the fact that we thought he was a little more prominent than he actually is. He worked with some of the most legendary British film directors, including David Lean. He was signed in 1963 by Universal Studios in Hollywood, where for the first 6 months, he had the chance to observe Alfred Hitchcock and many others making films. So he's
Spielberg.
Yeah, a good study. Yeah, exactly. That's almost like a key connection because we were just talking about Spielberg doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Before Peter Medak was given the job, two British directors were considered. One was Tony Richardson, who directed Tom Jones. He declined due to creative differences. Donald Cammell was the second chosen director for this film. He directed Demon Seed, which I talked about last year in a genre week topic. But he eventually left due to creative differences as well. And Peter Medak got the job. It was written by Russell Hunter and William Gray. I looked them up. Not really great movies. They did do RoboCop, or actually William Gray did RoboCop, The Philadelphia Experience, and the Hitchhiker series. Remember that series?
Oh, yeah. HBO?
Yeah. And then another writer on the script was Diana Maddox. And she, I looked her up. She's more of an actress than a writer. So I guess it was just connections that he had in Hollywood or in the film world. Screenwriter Diana Maddox and William Gray spent around 6 months doing research for the picture, which included copious newspaper articles on parapsychological encounters, over 700 books, and almost 2,000 case histories.
Wow.
So a lot of research went into this movie, which probably is what gives the story its depth, I would think.
Yeah, that would make sense.
It was filmed from December 4th, 1978 until February 25th, 1979, but it wasn't released until March of 1980, almost a year later. Hmm. So do you think he spent all that time in post?
No, no. It must have been some other reason. Not in 1980, you wouldn't spend that much time in post.
Okay. Yeah, because, that's a long time.
Think about it. The effects in this are practical. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it so scary and good and feels realistic is because the practicality of it and the simplicity of it, the seance, the ball, all of that. So.
Yeah, and it looks like one of those gritty 70s movies that we love, even though it's 1980. It's like the very tail end of that era of filmmaking.
Well, to your point, it has a lot of key things like a very Friedkin feel to it, a very Scorsese film, early Scorsese. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to talk about scenes?
We can, yeah. We can talk about scenes. I think the opening, like you said, is very graphic, very good, very great. It establishes the entire kind of intent very well. It also showcases Scott already in the first scene and his acting ability, which is great. I've got, of course, the bouncing ball down the steps.
That's like sequence. The best scene in this whole movie.
From the bouncing down and kind of the shot is from the side of the staircase looking at him way in the other room in the chair. He comes out, picks up the ball. Then it cuts to him on a bridge, throwing it over. Then it cuts back to him coming home, and as it goes in the door and is turning around to lock it, we hear the thumping, and he looks up, and the ball comes down, and we get this, it's in the foreground, he's in the background look. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's an incredibly scary moment. And I it's one of those, if I had to choose 10 top scary moments of 70s horror, that would be one of them. Maybe even all horror, because I just remember how chilling it was to think he threw that ball off a bridge into a river.
Yeah.
And then he comes home and it comes rolling down the steps.
Yeah. I like I read some reviews. This is a side tangent, but I read some reviews where people were saying it didn't make sense, or it was mundane, or it was kind of boring, or Scott leaps to conclusions too fast, his character does. And I went, really? I didn't get that at all. I got a very pragmatic approach in this, which worked and added to me to the mystery. Like you said, he accepts from the beginning based on these things. He's not going, oh, well, it's obvious. There's got to be an explanation. That can't be. He goes, no, my house is freaking haunted.
Well, and think about how he discovers it. He's a composer and he's writing a song, like not a song, but whatever you would call it, a piece of music in his house. And it is a certain theme. And George C. Scott learned that, by the way, which was very unique to see an actor actually playing a song like that. And then he later finds a secret room behind a door, behind a wall. And he finds a music box in that room that is playing that song that he wrote.
Yes.
It's an old, so no wonder he's convinced immediately, because that could never happen.
Right.
Unless there was something supernatural involved.
Well, and the seance is very convincing, of course, and very good.
A good scene,
that's
too.
That's another one of my scenes that I like.
Mm-hmm. One of my scenes, and it's not even a scene, it's a shot, is when they first get to the enormous house in the beginning behind me in that picture. He meets with the historian that's going to let him rent it or whatever, and they get in the car, and as they drive, that overhead shot of them going through the woods to the house is just enormous. I was amazed. I was like, wow. It was a helicopter, because it was not a drone at that age. But
correct. It would either have to be a crane or a helicopter.
Right. And if it was a crane, it would have to be an extremely long one. I don't think it could have been, because it goes over the woods. You see the car through the trees.
Yeah.
Driving to the house. Yeah. Amazing shot.
That's a good one. I also have another one that's kind of a shot, but it's a cut shot. It's the death of the John Colicos character. He drives away, and then it cuts to Russell, and he goes over to the mirror and he smashes the mirror. And right when he doesn't smash it, it cracks. And right when it cracks, we cut to that slow zoom push in on the broken windshield and Colicos' dead face there, the detective's dead face.
And the car is upside down.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was a really cool shot. That was really neat.
It's a very weird death, too. It's like, unexplained. That car is upside down.
Yeah, you get the impression that something, a bird, something ran through the windshield.
Yeah.
Killed him.
It's very, very strange.
Yeah. That's another good scene.
Yeah. The scene with the staircase catching on fire.
Classic.
Yeah. Very classic. And he actually sees the real Carmichael going up the steps, even though it's not real. It's like, it's a vision, I guess you would say.
Yeah. I think it's presented as a vision because it's like a guilt admission sort of thing.
Right.
It's Carmichael. Yeah.
He's looking at the picture with the medallion hanging off of it and kind of I don't know. It's just like this supernatural thing where he's there, but he's also in the house.
Yes. Yeah.
And reliving whatever.
And then I've got also the murder itself is a good scene. Both times we see the reenactment of the murder is really good.
Yeah.
Well shot, well filmed.
And before that, the scene where he is investigating the banging, and it's what we know later on is it's the kids being drowned in a tub, and he's banging on the side of the tub. It's a metal tub, and it echoes. And the scene where George or John, is that his name? John goes up to investigate, and for a second, he sees the boy drowning in the tub. That shocked me. I was like, I had forgotten about that. I thought he was just going to see an empty tub, and he actually sees the boy drowning in the tub, and it freaks him out. That's another thing that shakes him and convinces him that the house is haunted as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and like one of my fourth watch notes is I really like the fact that he immediately jumps to the metaphysical and doesn't try to explain everything away. Mm-hmm. Because other movies that we are watching for this particular Christmas holiday that we're doing, they make excuses for what they're seeing. And instead, no, you got to accept that. Get out of that. Sort of thing. So, yeah.
Look at you dropping hints. That's funny. Okay, that's, I guess, all the scenes I can think of. Yeah. I mean, I was going to mention the fact that George was really playing that piano. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, and there's other great scenes in this movie, but I love the scene where he goes into the classroom for the first time, and it is literally packed, which is kind of showing his popularity in the composer world. It's kind of like if John Williams was teaching a class at your university.
That's a great scene. You're right, because it looks like there's not even – it's like standing room only.
Oh, yeah.
And they
and his, his explanation of – I know that there's only 12 students signed up for this class.
Yeah. He downplays it really self-deprecatingly almost. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very funny. So we know he's a popular composer and a popular teacher as well. I can move on to cast if we're done with scenes.
Sure. Yeah.
Another reason the movie works is because of the cast, and namely the fact that it is George C. Scott as John Russell. I mentioned that he learned to play the piano for this, which I thought was interesting. But we covered him, what was it, last season we did Dr. Strangelove? So that was the first movie I think we've done with him. And he is rapidly becoming one of my favorite actors to rediscover. Because
well said. Yeah, I agree with that.
I've been going back and trying to catch more of his films because he is really, really good. Before I move into further into mainstream casting, I do want to mention that there is a first appearance in this movie of a current modern actor when he was just several months old. Do you know who that is?
Several months old? No, yeah. I do not know who
the baby was Joshua Jackson.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, I did not know that at all.
And wasn't this filmed in Vancouver?
Yes.
So maybe he's Canadian. I didn't look into that. I didn't do any research, but
well, obviously.
But you mentioned where it was filmed. It's set in Seattle, but it was filmed in Vancouver. So it was long before the X-Files and a lot of other things were filming up there. But I guess it was at the beginning of the film industry in Vancouver, maybe?
Yeah, this is essentially the 80, 81, or 79, 80. That time is when everybody's suddenly realizing
Vancouver. It's cheaper to film in Canada.
Cheaper. And it's before it became known as Hollywood North, but yeah.
Okay. I just thought that was interesting. Joshua Jackson, little baby. Opposite George C. Scott, we have Trish Van Devere, who is his real-life wife. She's either his second or third wife. He was married to Colleen Dewhurst before her, and I believe Campbell Scott, his son, was Colleen's son. I don't think, I think Trish came later. Trish Van Devere really was not a huge actress. She was known mainly for being on One Life to Live, the soap opera.
Okay.
However, she did star in another horror movie this very same year. Do you remember that?
No.
It's not a very
Was big it good?
One. I don't really remember. I kind of want to rewatch it now. It's called The Hearse.
Oh.
The Hearse?
Sure. I'm sure we probably watched it on VHS.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember it at all.
No, I don't either. All I can think of is that show or that hearse driver in Burnt Offerings.
Or in the, what's the one with the spinny ball? Phantasm?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, Trish plays Claire Norman. John's,
they are both great together, though. Their chemistry is really strong.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, it kind of works that way when you're involved with someone, I think. Melvin Douglas is in this movie. I was kind of shocked. I had forgotten he was in this movie. He had done another movie you really like around that time called Being There.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in HUD, which is a movie I rewatched a couple of summers ago. He's one of the 9 actors who have won the Triple Crown of Oscar, Emmy, and Tony.
Deserved it. Yep.
Yeah. He is the grandfather of Ileana Douglas. I had no idea. Did you?
I don't know who Ileana Douglas is.
Ileana Douglas, you would recognize her immediately if you saw her. Have you ever seen To Die For, that Gus Van Sant movie with Nicole Kidman? Where she plays the real bitchy new, like, newscaster or whatever.
News weather girl or something. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, she, Ileana Douglas is the one that Nicole screws over the entire movie. And at the very end, she's ice skating over Nicole Kidman's grave. It's one of my favorite endings to a film. It's like the whole thing of I would spit on your grave or whatever. I piss on your grave. She's actually ice skating on her grave. Anyway, she's a little ethnic. Look, she kind of looks like Talia Shire. That'd be a good comparison. Anyway.
Okay, so gotcha.
He is the grandfather of Ileana Douglas. He actually did another horror movie this year that you should remember, I would think. It's on our list. We haven't covered it.
Melvin Douglas did another horror movie.
This year, 1980. Actually, 81.
Another horror movie. Oh.
Think Old Men.
The one with all of them, old men in it. Yeah. Ghost Story.
Ghost Story with Fred Astaire and I think Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Melvin Douglas. A bunch of old actors did that movie.
Remember, that's where I first met Alice Krieg, who later on became the Borg Queen in Star Trek.
Exactly.
She's the ghost in that or something. She's the victim or whatever.
She is. Both. Yeah. We should cover that movie. I need to bump that up.
That would be a good one.
So, we have Melvin Douglas, and then we have, he plays Senator Carmichael, by the way, the kid that has grown up, the adopted kid that ended up taking the real John Carmichael's place.
The literal changeling.
Yeah, and we really didn't explain that, but the real John Carmichael was killed by his father because he was sickly and was not going to live to be 21 to inherit the fortune of the Carmichaels. So the father kills him and adopts a kid and pretends that he's the real heir, which is kind of sick and morbid when you think about it.
Yeah, it's a scary, it's a twisted story.
It is. It is. John Colicos plays Captain DeWitt. We know him very well. He is a Star Trek actor. He played Kor in Errand of Mercy. I'm just seeing if David's paying attention.
He actually was on Battlestar Galactica before this. He had already been Baltar before this. So
I know, but he was way back on the original Star Trek.
Well, he was Kor.
Right.
Commander Kor.
Commander Kor, the Klingon, right?
One of the very first Klingons.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And a very familiar face, a very familiar 70s television face.
Yes.
Before it goes through a windshield.
Yeah, he only has that one scene in this, literally.
I don't have a picture.
Like maybe six lines, and that's it.
You know, you're right. Sort of thing. Yeah, I don't even have a picture of him. Who else? Barry Morris plays the parapsychologist. Madeline Sherwood plays Mrs. Norman as she was Madeline Thornton Sherwood. And then really that's it, I think. I'm rolling through some of the secondary cast and I'm not seeing anything that
Barry
jumps out.
Barry Morris, I recognized and went, where do I know him from? Ended up looking him up. He was on Space 1999. He was the doctor in Space 1999, the McCoy character.
And he's the parapsychologist in this.
Yeah.
Bernard Behrens looked very familiar to me as well. He played Robert Lingstrom, but I don't really know what he's from, and I didn't look him up. As far as awards, the Saturn Awards nominated this movie for Supporting Actor with Melvin Douglas and International Film, because I guess it was billed as a Canadian film. I don't know. It also, as a posthumous, I have a problem saying that word, award of Best Blu-ray of 2019. So that makes me think, I want to see this Blu-ray. What's so great about it? Because 2019 is not that long ago for an award-winning Blu-ray to be out there. Boston Society of Film Critics awarded it Best Rediscovery of 2018, probably because they saw an advanced copy of the Blu-ray, I guess. And the Fanta Festival awarded Scott Best Actor. The Genie Awards, this is a Canadian awards, awarded it 9 wins from 11 nominations. It's a Canadian film, duh. But so that's pretty impressive that it won 11 nominations and 9 wins. It is not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list, and I'm not really sure how I feel about that.
Me too. I think I would include it just because it is one of my top favorite ghost stories ever and haunted house stories.
Yeah.
If it has incredible production design.
It does.
Williams, I want to call out Trevor Williams. He was excellent in this.
And if it was on the list of 100 best horror movies, it would definitely be included. But 1001 movies, I don't know. I think it belongs
maybe
on
not,
there. But
it might slip off. Based on whatever, but we have covered ones that should not be on there. So put this one in its place.
Fantastic Planet.
Yeah. Get rid of that one. Put Changeling in.
I agree. So that's what I have for cast and awards. We can move on if you want. Did you have any other trivia maybe?
I do. Did I have the trivia that I never knew until I researched this, that this was actually supposedly based on a real incident. And I never knew that until I did the research on this movie.
Okay.
But Russell Hunter was a playwright and he moved into a house, was haunted by a bouncing ball or a sound of a bouncing ball that he heard. He ended up having weird bangs in the house, very poltergeist activity, but bangs in the house, doors opening,
wheelchairs chasing you down staircases.
None of that, but but paintings falling off walls, that sort of thing. He actually found a secret staircase hidden behind a closet, and the staircase led to an attic room. And in the attic room, he found a trunk, and in that trunk was a child's diary of a 9-year-old boy claiming that his parents kept him hidden up there because he was a cripple.
I thought you were going to say his body.
No, Hunter, the playwright and the screenplay writer had a seance in the house. The medium said that the only thing that added to the story is the child was destined to inherit a fortune. That's why the parents had to keep him alive. But he died, and so his parents pulled the changeling idea. Hunter, and according to the research I've done, and this is two different sites, eventually Hunter was totally driven from the house. He moved to a different house. The entity still followed him, and he actually had a priest perform an exorcism in the new house.
Wow.
I did not know any of that until I started researching this project.
That's very interesting. Well, it makes sense because we talked about the writers, the woman, Diana Maddox, and William Gray.
Russell Hunter, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Diana Maddox and William Gray in particular, like, went through thousands of case studies and must have come across what you came across.
Yeah.
In order to do that.
He actually did like a huge tape recording kind of thing and sent it to the publisher and the filmmaker, producer, sort of thing. And he even attempted to write the first entry into the screenplay, but he was a playwright, not a screenplay writer, and it didn't really work. That's why they hired Gray. And Gray ended up changing the lead's character name to Russell in homage to Russell Hunter. So there you go. Found that all out. I thought that was really cool.
That is really cool.
Let's see. Trivia wise.
I have for trivia. Yep. I've got, hang on. Basically, just several little snippets of people that really love this movie. First being director Martin Scorsese included it in his top 11 scariest horror films. I wonder why he said 11. I wonder what the other 10 are.
Right.
Of all time. And we've often joked about, and you even mentioned watching Shutter Island, I think, last week, yep, about Martin Scorsese being such a horror movie fan. Why didn't he direct more horror movies?
I think he appreciates other people doing them, not him.
I guess. Or maybe he's worried he won't do them as well. In a featurette for the DVD release, actress Neve Campbell from Scream named it as her scariest film of all time. Spanish filmmaker Alejandro Amenabar, if I'm saying that right, has claimed in several interviews that this is his all-time favorite movie, up to the point of inspiring several scenes of Thesis from 1996 and The Others from 2001. I know The Others, so that must be the director of The Others. And lastly, acclaimed horror writer Stephen King cited this film as one of his favorite horror films. He said there are no monsters bursting from chests, just a child's ball bouncing down a flight of stairs, enough to scare the living daylights out of me.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was perfect for King, taking something that's very practical and making it horrific, mm-hmm, kind of thing, which is what this did. But there were reviews that I read of it, even like either one of them, Siskel or Ebert, I can't remember, but he said the problem with this movie was that you never felt like the lead was in peril, and he never really acted scared, so this isn't really a scary movie. And I thought about it, and my whole thing is, And I want to talk about in comparison to the trio we're doing right now, is one is this was a very adult relationship, it felt like. We got a lead character, a protagonist, and a female support for him, but they didn't have to have a huge love scene. They didn't have to have a great perilous journey together sort of thing, but it was still great chemistry and a good story. And this was a haunting that results in an investigation and not a huge battle or fear fest at the end.
Does, yeah,
that make sense?
Absolutely. It is. It's a quiet horror movie.
Well, yeah. It's the horror is there. And like King says, you'd be terrified by just a bouncing ball coming down the stairs. Mm-hmm. But it's not this huge panic chase. The poltergeist is attacked. Even in Sixth Sense, there's a lot of feeling of, it's going to hurt me. The poltergeist is attacking us, sort of thing. And that's not what this is. The boy just wants justice.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
And there's other scenes I'm starting to think of that I forgot to mention. And one is when the boy is going kind of nuts at the end, making noises and slamming doors or whatever. And George C. Scott starts yelling at him. He's like, what, yeah, the fuck? I can't. What do you want me to do? That kind of thing.
What do you want me to do?
Yeah, yeah. And he's just wanting the story out there of what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the only other thing I can mention is there are a lot of landmark Vancouver buildings, like I said, in this movie, that when he goes to Carmichael's house, that is actually Hatley Castle, British Columbia. That's the governor's residence of British Columbia.
Oh, cool.
And I think that house doesn't look as cool as his house is, and his house is a set.
That's funny.
Hotel Europe was another location. That's where that's the restaurant. And then that's the real estate office, that flat iron looking cool building in the middle of the block where George has another cigarette. By the way, smoking a lot in this movie.
A lot of smoking. Okay. Yeah.
It's 1979. You can do that.
Yeah. It's ironic that we're talking about Vancouver because Dennis and I watched Samantha Brown last night one of her favorite places was Vancouver. And I was like, I want to go there. Actually, I kind of want to live there.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Vancouver's beautiful.
Yeah. It's a little cool and wet, but.
I also saw that Peter Medak turned down many, many, many horror projects after this. He was approached and he said he didn't want to do horror again. He didn't want to do the genre.
I wonder if Hannibal was his first venture back into it.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Back into fear.
And that's a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. But he did a bunch of television. There's a bunch of television episodes that he did. And he's a very accomplished, I think, director. Worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm?
Keys?
Poltergeist is my first one.
Is it?
just because of the whole... Well, Poltergeist kind of slash Sixth Sense. It's that same thing where simplistic things become scary in Poltergeist, especially at the beginning, like Poltergeist when she turns around and all the furniture in the kitchen is sacked up and moved. And in Sixth Sense, when she turns around and suddenly every cabinet in the kitchen is open and it was closed just a second ago.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of foreboding stuff, signs. And to me, that's like the bouncing ball. This is coming from somewhere and we as sure as hell didn't do it.
Well, I think another thing that you didn't touch on is that those were all practical effects as well.
True.
Yeah.
True.
And so they're very effective because the one in Poltergeist, the camera just goes one way and then it comes back and all of a sudden all those chairs are stacked there. So somebody had to push mm-hmm. that chair sculpture into the room and hit its mark or whatever. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. great. I have going back, I would say The Haunting of Hill House, which is
oh yeah
Shirley Jackson, the novel. But you've also got The Haunting, the movie Robert Wise did. In 63, yep. I believe. So that I think that's a monumental ghost story. As far as ghost stories involving children, The Innocents is another one that just occurred to me.
Mm-hmm. The Others, The Innocents, Orphanage.
Mm-hmm. I've never seen Orphanage. Have you?
I watched like the first half hour of it and then I couldn't get it again. It was taken off my streaming service, so I didn't watch
it. Oh, was it good?
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Okay. Actually. All right. I need to see it then. Okay. It's a Spanish film, isn't it?
Yes.
I think it is. Orphanage.
I think it's produced by Del Toro.
I think it was too. Yeah. I have The Shining. It's not a hotel, but it's pretty big.
Yeah, I could see that.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Amityville Horror, which is basically... It came out around the same time and is a haunted house, a notorious American haunted house.
Mm-hmm. I've got Penny Dreadful because I don't know if it definitely influenced the writer of Penny Dreadful, but the seance scene in this is really, really good, and so is the one in Penny Dreadful.
Okay. So, well, speaking of seance scenes, Don't Look Now. And that we just did that last week, and that has a good seance in it as well as it centers around a child. And this centers around a child. So you've got those keys as well.
But I think the cool thing about this one is it has so many of the references that are that you read about later on that seances really do, whether it's the ghost riding like she was, or the You record it and you don't hear anything in the room, but when you play the recording back, you hear the voice sort of thing. People mm-hmm. do that like on graveyards all the time. They talk about going to graveyards and recording.
That would be Paranormal Activity as well, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
it would be. I have another key that reaches out to several different haunted house movies, too, in particular, that I can think of. And that's where the ghost is highly active because it wants you to find its body. And they find its body. They find the boy's skeleton. It's in a separate house, but it's on the same property. It's like a servant's quarters or something. I can't remember what it was. But remember, it wasn't in the actual house. It was in someone else's house.
Yeah, it was in someone else's house, but it wasn't even near the same property. It was on the other side of the lake kind of thing, but it was owned by Carmichael.
At the time, and now someone else owned it, and George C. Scott's character was led to the house, yes. And that's where they find the boy's body. But to go back to other movies that do that, I have two examples. One we just talked about, Ghost Story, where they find her body in the lake.
In the car.
And then another one that I use very much like that old science fiction movie, Where Have All the People Gone? On the horror side, there's an old TV movie called The House That Wouldn't Die with Barbara Stanwyck. And they find two lovers' skeletons buried together in the basement of that house. And that explains why that house is haunted. So that would definitely be a key. Actually, that movie came out before this movie, so maybe they got ideas. I don't know.
There's also another one that's similar, Woman in Black, which was a play, I think, first, and then became a movie. But it's the same thing. You've got to find the body to put the spirit to rest.
Right.
Sort of thing.
Right. What else do I have?
I have one I copped from online, but I thought it was interesting. And it said, this movie was obviously a huge influence on The Ring, or Ringu, because it's supernatural, it's a ghost, it's a child. Recording media is an important part of the whole plot.
Okay, yeah.
And there's a body in a well.
Oh, yeah, because it's a well underneath the house. You're right. I forgot about that.
So I thought, well, yeah, that is.
Well, cool. Yeah.
Yeah, well.
That's funny. Back to the others. We mentioned the director is Alejandro Amenábar. We mentioned that. Well, there's obviously connections because there's a kid. It centers around children. But also, Mrs. Tuttle was named for the caretaker in the others, Mr. Tuttle here and Mrs. Tuttle there. So they even use the same name. So it's a little Easter egg or homage for that. And then I only have one other that is on the top of my head right now, and that is there's a reboot in development for this film. So there's a potential key there.
I had heard that. And I was trying to remember, though, like Conjuring does Conjuring have a body in the basement? We watched it recently, but I don't remember.
No, I don't think so. I think the story kind of gets absorbed by the possession of her. And all of a sudden, you've got the whole possession story. I don't remember any bodies being found in that movie.
And Annabelle and the doll and all that stuff.
That is on my list to watch because we talk about it so much.
What, Annabelle?
Yeah. I know I'm going to hate it, but I feel like I need to watch that movie.
Another one which is that you made me think of it, and I had to just now look it up. It was the Kevin Bacon one, Stir of Echoes.
That's Richard Matheson.
That's another one where we're trying to find a body, though, too.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that in a very long time, but you know,
I love
Richard Matheson. It's on our list as well.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Yeah. Kevin's not afraid to do horror movies. He does a lot of horror movies. He started pretty much in horror movies with Friday the 13th.
The last one I have is just like a technique, and it really came about, I think, post Jaws a lot. But Jaws, Halloween, Friday the 13th, all of those influenced by that POV essence. He does it very subtly here, but he does it here, where Scott's investigating and you see the camera's like ground level creeping around like a staircase or going around the door looking at her, or it cuts to the staircase to the attic and you see the door slowly close kind of stuff. But that moving POV where we feel like we're the bad guy, the ghost, the whatever. In it.
But do you have an example?
Well, like Friday the 13th is the first one that jumped to mind.
That's where you're the killer POV.
I'm behind a tree watching somebody the whole time. But Halloween, from the very beginning, we follow his POV up the stairs to her and killing her and everything. So there's a lot of this, we're suddenly the essence of the killer or the bad guy or the ghost or the whatever.
Yeah, I'm almost. Yeah, I see what you're saying. It's just it's the way a lot of horror movies are shot. It's like that.
But they didn't used to be. Hitchcock never really showed POV from the killer's point of view. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Our early 70s, like The Exorcist, we never see from a demon's point of view. We might cut to that hallway with the door, and we're slowly pushing in on the door, getting closer and closer, and everything. But we don't. Sneak around corners and then suddenly cut to the other character sort of thing. So, as a matter of fact, I don't think Sixth Sense did that either later on, but you see what I mean? So I think it's a technique.
It is.
Certain horror people use.
But it's almost, in some cases, it's the killer's POV, and in other cases, it's more an omniscient POV where you go, like in Halloween, it's the killer POV in the beginning, but in the end, it's like all the places the killer did bad stuff or whatever.
Correct. But I think that's a change. I'm speaking specifically of the times when you see it from Jason's point of view or Michael Myers' point of view.
Right. Or, like through the mask holes of the eyes. Yeah.
Yeah, or just the way the shot is done, so it's creeping around looking at the hero or the victim sort of thing. So, yeah, there's that.
Yeah, and I think there is a good bit of that in Haunted House stuff, now that you mention it, because they want you to make, they want you to feel there's a presence. I watched that movie Presence not long ago with Lucy Liu, and they do some similar stuff in that as well.
Okay.
I'll put that down. But that's all I have as far as keys. I'm sure there's a million others. Any haunted house movie, obviously.
Of course. Of course.
But this is a good one.
Yeah. Very, very good one. And we would love, that's what Tim and I think. We think it's very, very good. We'd hope to learn if you guys think it's very, very good. If you haven't seen this movie, why did you listen to all of this before watching it? But go back and watch it. But love to know your comments down below. Leave us comments, leave us reviews. If you can, reviews always help other people find us and other fans out there. So please do that. If you like, if you're new and you like what you heard or saw today, you're welcome to go back to our website and see any of our past episodes. We've been doing it for quite a few years now, and or join us on Patreon, where we have some free materials, but also tiered materials that are really cool, including other podcasts and other topics that we cover. And it's Christmas time and we're continuing our binge. Is it?
No. Haunted Holidays.
Haunted Holidays.
It is. It's the Haunted Holidays. And there's only 17 days left until shopping days left until Christmas. So get on it, Mr. Horton. But in those 17 days, we have one episode remaining before we take a short break over the holidays. And that will air next Monday. And it is another Haunted House movie. And it's a biggie.
Another haunted house. It's a big, yeah.
Yep.
So Tim, we'll be spooky then, I guess.
Yeah, you will, and I will see you then.
All right.
All right. Bye.